I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, billionaires, reflections on the upper crust. Daryl West is our guest. Daryl is Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. He is the author of many books on American politics. And he started to think about this book during the 2012 presidential election when a number of very wealthy individuals poured large amounts of money into the candidates' coffers. Since then, he says, it has become apparent that such support is not an aberration, but evidence of a substantial wave of campaign financing of sometimes unknown origin that is inundating the American political system and that of many other countries around the world. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Daryl on billionaires, their political influence that we don't know about because there aren't records due to Citizens United, and what happens when wealth is concentrated in this very few, well, it's what, 1,675. 491 are in the United States of America. But their numbers, our guest says, that there will be new millionaires created over the next 8 to 10 years, and we're looking at 1,700, 1,800 new billionaires. How in the world do you even become a billionaire? I mean, that's so much money, isn't it? So this should be a really interesting conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Lines are open for you all hour. Hi, Daryl West.
Kathleen, nice to be with you.
Very nice to have you here, sir. You know, it's hard for me to even imagine. I know that there are close to 200,000 of these people. I mean, 2,000 people. How many? 1,000? Almost 2,000 in the world.
There are about 1,600 billionaires around the world, and about one-third of them live in the United States.
It's just hard for me to imagine what that even means, to have $1 billion. How much? Give us a comparison. How much money is that?
It's a lot.
That's what I was thinking.
About the top 1%, billionaires actually are the 0.00001%.
What is it, zeros?
They're like five zeros and then a
one.
Wow. So this is a very exclusive club.
Wow, it sure is. And what was astounding to me in reading a good chunk of your book is the amount of political interest these people have, and let's center on the United States first, and the amount of political influence they have. These people vote in huge numbers.
They do. They're very politically active at a time when most citizens, ordinary people, are very cynical about the political process and therefore disengaged. And, you know, we just had this midterm election where two-thirds of eligible voters did not even turn out to cast their vote. Billionaires know that politics matter. They know that government can play a big role, positively or negatively, in their businesses. They're very engaged. They really try and influence the process in a lot of different ways.
And their politics on the whole, and give me numbers on this, tend to be fairly conservative.
Yes, that is the case. If you go back and look at the 2012 elections where the big money was coming into the process, which was mainly through the so-called super PAC organizations, 80% of that money came in on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. Now, there are liberal billionaires. Certainly George Soros has been very active on issues like immigration reform. Michael Bloomberg has taken a more moderate position. There was a climate change activist named Tom Steyer who spent $65 million in the 2014 elections. But still, they are exceptions. The bulk of the money is coming in on the conservative side.
And the concerns are, the issue concerns would be one, two, three. Number one would be taxation, what they feel is excessive taxation of their enormous amounts of money.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, we could have a democracy where there are conservative billionaires spending a lot and liberal billionaires spending a lot, and, you know, there's some rough balance of power. But there are issues like tax policy, especially raising taxes on the wealthy, where it really doesn't matter if you are a liberal or a conservative billionaire. the people I know, even if they might agree with Obama on 80% of the issues, opposed him on the issue of raising taxes on the wealthy. And so, you know, this is an issue that's so fundamental, it creates problems for every other policy area because, you know, if you don't have the revenue coming in, mm-hmm. you can't spend money on health care, you can't spend money on education. There are lots of other things that don't get funded.
And when you have that kind of money, your objection to a little bit of an increase in taxes of your incredible amount of money would be what? What? Why would you object?
Well, you know, if you have $1 billion, you want two. If you have five, you want 10.
Wow.
You know, there's always somebody who has more.
Yeah.
And so people have this natural impulse not to want to pay taxes. And so even if you're a billionaire and paying an extra $1 million or $2 million is actually not going to affect your material quality of life that much, you still don't want to do it.
You talked about the voluntary giving pledge in the book, where wealthy individuals are pledging to give away half their assets during their lifetime instead of transferring them. I was amazed how few people have signed on to that.
There are more than 100 people, who 100 billionaires, that is, who have signed up for the giving pledge to give away half of their fortunes during their lifetime. But as you point out, that's less than 10% of all of the billionaires. Most of the ones who've done it are in the United States, where we have this long history of philanthropy, and we have a number of very wealthy individuals who've been incredibly generous in supporting universities, hospitals, churches, synagogues, and so on. But it's been almost impossible. This was a Bill Gates and Warren Buffett idea. It's been almost impossible for them to find billionaires outside of the United States who are willing to do this.
I loved Warren Buffett's quote that you put in the book. If you have trouble living on $500 million, I'm going to put out a book on how to live on $500 million.
I know. I was really amused at that comment. It's actually a very radical comment, though, if you think about it, because he's basically saying, you know, people don't need more than that amount of money. You can have several homes. You can have your private jet. You can have people who are cooking for you and cleaning your homes. You can live very comfortably on that. So he is one of the exceptions. You know, he's a billionaire who did support raising taxes on the wealthy. You know, he was upset when he discovered his assistant actually had a higher tax rate than what he did.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that amazed me is that there was kind of an overall feeling among many of these billionaires that public education wasn't necessarily a very good thing. You know, who cares about health care for all? It was this very selfish view of everybody else who's not very wealthy.
Well, this is something that concerned me a lot because I actually grew up in the Midwest. I grew up on a dairy farm in Ohio, but I was fortunate that I got a great education and then, you know, I've had lots of opportunities in my life. But, you know, it's a lot harder for young people today. You know, education is more expensive. Buying the first house is very expensive.
Yes.
Getting health care is expensive. And so my concern is that as a society, we have lost this sense of social and economic opportunity, which has been the bedrock of the American dream. And some of the billionaires, we looked at some of the research that's been done comparing the policy views of the ultra-wealthy with the views of ordinary Americans. And in general, their views were much more conservative. They didn't want to put a lot more money into education. They didn't want to pay higher taxes. They wanted a more limited role for government. They didn't want government regulating their industries.
Hmm. But you can't continue to be a billionaire, can you, if nobody else is doing very well? Don't they have to buy your product?
Well, this is an insight that Henry Ford had decades ago when he paid his factory workers more than twice the going rate at the time. And, you know, someone asked him why he did that. And he said, look, you know, this is not just altruism. Like, I need customers. You know, we need, in capitalism, you need people who are able to buy these products. And I think a lot of people have lost that insight. I actually think it's one of the reasons why our economic recovery has been so slow and it's been difficult to recover, that the inequality has reached a point where some people are doing incredibly well, but wages for the average worker have really stagnated for 30 years now, and they don't have the money to purchase the products anymore. And so it's hard to sustain the economy when you have inequality that has reached that kind of level.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get more billionaires with that kind of economy?
Well, we are getting more billionaires. I mean, each time Forbes magazine does one of these analyses, they add several hundred. And certainly the Thomas Piketty book showed that if you have financial assets, you know, your money in many years is going to grow 10%, 15% or higher. And so, you know, someone like the Koch brothers who have David and Charles Koch have $84 billion between the two of them. You know, if their money grows 10% a year, that's an additional $8 billion every year.
Goodness
so,
gracious.
You know, when you have money, it begets more money.
Boy, does it ever. And you talk about, and what about in terms of healthcare? You make the point in the book, you talk about when you were 11, I think, and you got rheumatic fever, and that you needed to have a healthcare system in place that would work for somebody like you. Your family was not very wealthy in order for you to be able to have the life that you've had and graduate, you know, from and teach at prestigious schools and write these books. And I mean, there was your life that could have been gone when you were at the age of 11.
Yeah, I told that story about having a rheumatic fever at age 11 just to make the very simple point that sometimes small investments in healthcare and in education can pay off big time. So I was fortunate that, you know, I got treatment, I recovered, I went on to get a PhD, I taught for 26 years at Brown University, and now I'm at Brookings. So I've had incredible opportunities, but, you know, it's a lot harder today. You know, we have a lot of people who don't have health insurance. So we have people who don't have the educational opportunities that I was able to get 30 and 40 years ago. And so, you know, on a long-term basis, we need to maintain that upward mobility and that sense of social and economic opportunity that has been the bedrock of the United States.
And the Affordable Care Act, you make mention of, that it has been able to have a very beneficial effect, increasing real income for some families by as much as 5.3%, which is significant.
It certainly is. That's an analysis that some of my economist colleagues at Brookings undertook, and they kind of looked at the income levels of people and then the income levels when you add in the benefits of the Affordable Care Act, and they found, as you point out, that people's incomes went up substantially in part because of that legislation. So, you know, just providing basic health care can pay off for society in a lot of other ways. You know, it keeps people out of the emergency rooms of hospitals, which is the most expensive way to provide health care, but it also has positive spillover effects in terms of the economy, jobs. You know, people are paying taxes, so you know, it's something we as a society have to think about how to create that basic kind of opportunity.
So let's move to, before we go to phone calls, the political influence that this group of people has. It gets to the point where you can almost have your own individual senator who will take care of what your interest is because of the amount of money that you could probably get from those people and their friends when you have to run for office again. What is the amount of political influence, and what stories do you have to tell us about what they've been able to secure?
Well, in my billionaires book, I included one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons, which shows a wealthy individual in this very nice office saying, "I own one plane, two yachts, four houses, and five politicians." And when I was talking with some wealthy people about the book, there was one multi-millionaire who told me what he called a get a senator strategy, that, you know, we're familiar that in a gridlock Senate, one individual senator can filibuster a bill and stop it. One senator can put a secret hold on an appointment and keep that individual from going forward. So rich people know this. And so what a number of them try and do is to find a friendly senator who will do what they want. And so if a bill comes forward that you don't like or might be harmful for your particular industry, you can get that senator to block it. If the administration makes an appointment that you don't like, you can get that senator to place a secret hold. And so it's one way in which wealth, inequality, and congressional gridlock is intertwined in very unhealthy ways for the rest of society.
And so what do you get? What does the senator get in return? Money for a campaign donation or what?
The senator gets campaign contributions. Some of them get support for their favorite charities. I mean, there are all sorts of ways that you can curry favor with a senator.
And you also write, because the news media has become not as strong as it used to be, there aren't very many investigative reporters out there, that we may never even know about most of this.
That is a huge problem because certainly at the national level, we know that there's been a dramatic decline of media oversight just coming out of the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, and you know many newspapers downsized. But this has been a particular problem at the state and local level. Mm-hmm. Wealthy individuals know that, you know, at a time where it's hard to move legislation nationally, you can still go into state legislatures and into local communities and have great influence. And so a number of these individuals, and I have a chapter in my book where I talk about this, are now focusing on state referenda. They're trying to get policies enacted through public votes, some of them try and influence city council races, the school board elections. So they're active at the state and local level because they know that in many places there's a lot less media oversight there.
And it really goes every mining legislation that's happened in the state of Wisconsin, too.
Absolutely. Now, we're seeing that in a lot of different states, and this is true, you know, both for liberal and conservative billionaires who are becoming very politically active. So, you know, these people are trying to gain influence at every level of government. You know, if you spend $5 million on something in Tennessee or Virginia, that's a lot of money for a mid-sized state. So relatively small amounts of money for them can have a huge impact in terms of public policy.
We welcome phone calls and email messages as well. Our guest has written a fascinating book because I don't know any of these people personally. Maybe you do, but it's about billionaires. And it is titled Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. Daryl West is our guest. Daryl is Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. He studies politics avidly and has taught at Brown University for a number of years, has written 19 books on American politics. In 1925, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote a short story, The Rich Boy, in which he said, "Let me tell you about the very rich. They are different from you and me," and we're finding out how different this hour of the program. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where if you like us, which would be nice, then we can send you updates of shows that you'll want to be sure and here, because you'd hate to miss a show like today if you knew you wanted to hear it and then it's over and you thought, oh, I should have listened to that. You can in other ways, but if you wanted to listen to it live, this way you'll know what time the show is on. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for the author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. Daryl M. West is our guest, and John in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, John.
Hi. I was wondering, is he talking about that they're making, that the billionaires he's numbering are making $1 billion a year, or they're worth $1 billion, first of all?
They're worth $1 billion. We're talking about net worth and amount of assets that people have.
Right. I was wondering, the author there, your guest, has he ever heard and studied the history of Huey Long and the Share the Wealth program from the 1930s? And does he think that what might be a good idea that most of their wealth should be taxed away from them and spread amongst the people?
I am certainly familiar with Huey Long and his Share of the Wealth program. I don't think I would personally favor kind of exorbitant taxes on the wealthy. I think, you know, wealth creation is fine. It's part of our system. But I think there needs to be sufficient taxation to finance programs that help people of working class means do well in terms of providing educational opportunity, providing basic health services. And that's my concern about our current public policy, that our tax laws have been tilted in favor of the wealthy, and that some of the social programs that benefit middle-class people have been starved for resources.
Thanks, John, for the call. Paul writes, remember, these fortunes are not primarily cash, but they're comprised of investments. At this level, these individuals and families have enormous influence over what our society invests in and what we don't invest in.
That certainly is true. These individuals are very influential in many different walks of life. So we've talked a little bit about their political influence. Certainly, they are incredibly influential in the world of philanthropy. They have a big impact on society as a whole. They've created new products, new services. You know, much of the way that we communicate now electronically dates back to the work of some of the tech entrepreneurs who have become enormously wealthy.
What about philanthropy? You mentioned that briefly. Do the billionaires give enormous amounts of money to our libraries, to our symphonies, to keep our culture alive, to our universities? How generous are they?
Actually, people who are really wealthy in the United States do tend to be generous with their wealth. I mean, even the Koch brothers, who liberals hate, David Koch has contributed about $1 billion in philanthropy to hospitals, to arts and culture institutions, many of them located in New York City, but some other places as well. So there is a big tradition of philanthropy in the United States, and a number of these billionaires have been very active in that area as well.
Mm-hmm. And do you get big tax breaks for doing that?
You do get tax breaks for that. That's one of the reasons why philanthropy is more advanced here than in other places. In many European countries, there's no tax advantage to a philanthropic gift, and so people don't give the money if they're not getting a tax deduction for it.
What about running for office, Daryl? You mentioned that in some of the other countries that you write about in the book, a lot of people who are very, very wealthy have run for office and they've won. Is that true as well in the United States? And why is running for office and winning an attractive thing to do?
Well, this is one of the things that surprised me. When I started to look around the world, I discovered that billionaires actually have run for office in a dozen different countries, and in most of the cases, they've actually ended up winning. You know, one of the most prominent examples of this was Berlusconi in Italy, but more recently, Ukraine has a new president, Poroshenko, who is a billionaire. He runs chocolate factories. That's how he made his wealth. But when you look at the experience of what happens to countries when billionaires are serving as chief executive or as a prime minister, there invariably are complaints about insider dealing, corruption, using government to benefit your own particular businesses. So it almost always becomes a really bad story when you combine economic and political power in one individual.
What about in the U.S.? Have there been a number of billionaires who have successfully run for office?
We actually have not had very many billionaires who have sought office. Obviously, Michael Bloomberg is the most prominent success story in that area, having been elected mayor of New York three different times. Meg Whitman ran for governor of California, put an enormous amount of her own fortune into the race, but ended up losing big. Carly Fiorina sought office, put a lot of her own money in, and lost. And I think I do case studies of some of these American examples to kind of figure out, you know, why some were successful and some were not. And in the case of Bloomberg, even though he started out kind of advertising himself as a more conservative individual, he was a conservative who also wanted to talk about educational opportunity, bettering the lives of the middle class. And then he also put a lot of personal philanthropy into New York City. So he was not somebody who was seen as out for himself or, you know, just wanting to give all the benefits to rich people. When you look at Whitman and when you look at Fiorina's campaigns, both of them were much more narrowly focused, and they kind of got typecast as billionaires who supported policies that were going to benefit other rich people. And that was not a saleable message for either one of those candidates.
And Bloomberg, I'm wondering if you know how much money put a lot of money recently into gun violence.
He has. He put $50 million into fighting gun violence and taking on the NRA. He's invested a large amount of money in his anti-obesity campaign. So he's also been a big supporter of immigration reform, although he doesn't have a lot to show for that at this point. But, you know, he's somebody who's really put a lot into policy advocacy.
William is next in Milton. Hello, William.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the grandson of one of the two men who led the way, spearheaded the way for creation of the 8-hour day, 5-day work week.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Gus Hallberg. He had to have four last names. One of them was Hall. He's the gentleman who ran on the socialist ticket for president in the 70s. My grandfather, I'm not using his real last name, Oscar Sundstrom, Stremd, Strand, and Stremd. He had to have four last names also because they both were on the list to be murdered for trying to create, back in 1906, a humane work week. They had to work deep down in the iron ore mines for 12-hour days, 7 days a week. They went on strike. They spearheaded the strike, and that worked and worked and worked. In 1938, we got the 8-hour-day, 5-day work week, by which many people, fortunately, have an 8-hour-day, 5-day work week. Now,
yeah.
The reason why I'm calling
you. Yeah, William.
We need. Am I still here?
Yes, please. Get to the point, though.
Yeah, I guess Gus Ventura. He ran. Governor Ventura in Minnesota ran on a more or less third party. My question is there any possibility that we could get a third party in some states like they have third parties in Canada and England?
Well, there are some parties where there are very active third parties. There were libertarian candidates who ran in the 2014 election, but we all know it's very hard for third parties just because of all the barriers against them in terms of getting candidates on the ballot, getting media attention, being able to finance their campaigns. There was some talk a couple years ago about Bloomberg possibly being a third party candidate. He took a look at it and concluded it was impossible and he would not be successful doing that. So there certainly are a lot of barriers to third parties in the United States.
And thanks very much for the call. You got to wonder, because we keep doing show after show, and I'm sure you've written a lot of books about this, we keep being informed about the huge wealth disparity. It only keeps getting greater. It reminds us of the 1920s. It hasn't been as severe as since the 1920s. And you've got this 0.00001% of people who are just making gobs and gobs of money, that at some point something's got to give, you know, be it a third party, be it more people protesting, you know, in front of fast food restaurants or big chain stores saying the minimum wage has to go up. I just can't believe that you can have things be so difficult for so many people and just so extraordinarily good, if you even want to use that word, for being a billionaire, and not have there be resentment and not have there be a cry for, you got to tax this person a little bit much so that I can have the basic necessities of life. What does it take?
That's a very good question. There certainly are a lot of people who are upset with the status quo today, but people who are unhappy are divided between those who are upset with big government, and so they end up voting Republican, versus those who are upset with big business, and they end up voting Democratic. But it kind of diffuses the discontent among the general population. So it's when you look historically, what often motivates social and political action is some big event, some scandal. You know, Watergate obviously mm-hmm. motivated a lot of campaign finance reform. In a lot of respects, we have returned to a pre-Watergate era of big money and great secrecy in the political process. We know that that is toxic for democracy. So it really, I think, is only a matter of time before there is a major scandal. And then the question is whether that scandal will then motivate some type of more meaningful legislation.
Well, there was a scandal. It was on Wall Street in 2008, wasn't it?
There was, and we saw some legislation that came out of it, but the legislation didn't address a lot of the things that caused that, and we've not really addressed the political aspects, the political ramifications of big money, mainly because, as you mentioned in the introduction to the show, Supreme Court decisions basically have taken almost all of the rules off of campaign finance. So, you know, we have a lot less disclosure now. We've mm-hmm. seen the emergence of dark money. A few wealthy individuals can give tens or hundreds of millions of dollars trying to influence the process. So, you know, it's really, I think, a very grave threat to a democratic political system.
Roger in Madison sends an email. If I'm remembering correctly, when a politician has built up a large campaign fund account, at the time he or she retires, he or she can use those funds for any personal purpose they choose. If I'm right about that, then large campaign fund contributions can indeed greatly benefit a politician. Is that true?
It's true that politicians can accumulate large funds, but I don't think it's true in most states that they can then roll that over into their personal use. Most states have rules specifying that campaign funds have to be spent for some public purpose. Now, that can be a charitable contribution to a school or a nonprofit organization, some organization doing good things, but most states do not allow them to just roll over the money into their personal checkbook.
Gerald West, the author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. Frank in Onalaska. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a mistake, and I'm not saying the author's limiting it just to billionaires, but I think using the example of the U.S. Senate, where it's a millionaires club, focused just on that class of income known as billionaires, it's a greater class, 1%, 5%, 10% income that, you know, is affecting people's lives. I use as a further specific example that these folks are out of touch with the normal day-to-day lives. The well-known example of President Bush, number one, not being able to check out of a grocery store because he's never seen an electronic scanner, or Hillary Clinton saying that she hasn't driven a car since 1996. Hence, they don't have any idea of pumping gas and the cost of that. They're out of touch, and they make rules and policies that reflect their narrow focus. And it's a, you know, it's a moneyed club, and the Supreme Court, the Citizens United, continues to let it play that way, with the ridiculous premise that money like this doesn't influence to the point of bribery or even motivating policy decisions. The Supreme Court is neither; they're out of touch with America as well. They're not supreme, and they're not a court. They're totally politically motivated.
Daryl.
I focused on billionaires just to present the most extreme form of the problem as I see it. But your caller is absolutely right that, you know, this issue of inequality, money in politics, and excessive political influence is not limited to billionaires. Certainly multimillionaires, millionaires, other people with large amounts of financial resources, you know, many of the same arguments apply to them.
Mm-hmm. And somebody, I don't know if you can check this, but somebody has done a little research here. Philip wrote on our Facebook page, suppose I, Kathleen, were to give you, Daryl, $1 per second nonstop, 24 hours a day. At the end of the first day, you would have $86,000. 30 years later, you would be a billionaire. 30 years later.
That sounds good. Yeah. So let's do it.
I can't. I don't have the money for it. And you wouldn't want it anyhow, would you?
That's true. That would be such a burden.
I wouldn't want it either. No, sorry. Frank, thanks for your call. Gil in Hartford. Hi, Gil.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that as a society, we see somebody that hoards shoelaces and think of them as mentally ill. And I think we should think of somebody who hoards money in the same light.
Well, that's really the Warren Buffett point that, you know, above a certain level, and he said it was $500 million, people don't really need more money in order to live a very luxurious lifestyle.
And you write, it's not a huge part of the book, but the problems that families encounter, billionaire families, there are all kinds of squabbles. Sometimes people don't talk to each other. Who are you going to give the money to? Money becomes a burden for a lot of families.
It does. Money actually really complicates the personal and family lives of billionaires as well as multi-millionaires. I mean, having taught at Brown University, I had a number of students who were the children of the rich and famous, and a lot of them led difficult lives even though they obviously had a lot of money. And, you know, there were personal problems, emotional difficulties, sometimes substance abuse problems. So, you know, we all like to think, you know, if you have a lot of money, you have a very easy life. But there are a lot of challenges for people in that category as well.
Mm-hmm. Virginia is next in Green Bay. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say we don't have a democracy anymore. We have an oligarchy. And it's bought and paid for. And this last election showed it. And they say whatever they want to say, and it doesn't have to be true. If you had a truth meter on, you know, like Saturday Night live used to have one of those truth meters and would register false or true.
Mm-hmm.
Most things would register false. And nobody calls them on it anymore. The journalists that have people on and the people will be spewing all this stuff that's not true. And no one calls them on it. They don't say, well, that's not true. You're not speaking the truth. That's not what he said. Or anything anymore. And people just make up their own version.
Daryl.
I mean, there certainly does seem to be a lot of misinformation in politics these days, and it is tied together with this problem of wealth and inequality. I mean, you have rich people who are buying news outlets. So Murdoch has Wall Street Journal and Fox News. Michael Bloomberg purchased Business News. Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO, purchased the Washington Post. So, you know, when you have these people controlling the flow of information, that really gives them a lot of influence over how the process operates as well.
And as you said, when we're looking at what's going on in state houses and what's going on with huge industries coming into various states, you just don't have as many reporters on the beat. You know, the state beat, the city government beat, whatever it is, people aren't there anymore. There aren't any reporters who are covering that.
Yeah, I agree totally with that. I think the real problem is at the state and local level. I mean, there obviously are a lot of issues at the national level, but there still is pretty detailed news coverage there. There are people of differing persuasions that are active. But when you go to the state and local level, oftentimes that is not true. There's often not much media oversight. Sometimes there's not much political competition. It may be a one-party state. It may be a situation where a rich person who dumps $5 million into that state can really essentially buy that state. So, you know, we really need to worry about that kind of situation.
More phone calls in a moment. Daryl West, our guest, his book is Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You're listening this afternoon to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during our 2 o'clock hour, Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. Our guest is a professor and curator in the Museum of Paleontology and research paleoecologist at the University of California, Berkeley. And so we'll be looking at our global extinction crisis. All right, back to phone calls for Daryl. Ruth in Madison, hi.
Hi, thank you. I just wonder why everyone is so afraid to tax the so-called job creators who aren't creating any jobs at a fair rate. You know, because if you look at how much those of us in the lower incomes are paying, by the time you take your state and federal income tax, your employer and employee share of FICA, mm-hmm. your sales tax, your gas tax, you look at your gas and electric bill and see all the little taxes on that, and your phone bill and your cable bill and all that, all the little taxes, emergency service taxes, all these little taxes here and there, everywhere, tax, tax, tax. Now, I bet we're paying pretty close to 50% of our income in taxes. And if we taxed the wealthy at anywhere close to 50%, we wouldn't even have a national debt.
Daryl.
It would clear up everything.
I do have a chapter on tax policy in my book when I'm talking about kind of how people accumulate wealth and then how we should think about responding to it. And we all know that tax policies have been tilted in favor of the wealthy. Certainly that's been true for the income tax. It's true for the estate tax. The gift tax has been you know, there are ways people figure out to get around that as well. So it's been part of the challenge that our system faces that conservatives have been very successful at pushing their anti-tax views. And even when a few Democrats stand up and say, you know, we need the wealthy to pay more taxes, they often are very isolated and, you know, it's hard for them to win support.
Thank you, Ruth, very much for your call. Rich writes, it's my understanding that many billionaires are billionaires due to inherited wealth. It's one thing to earn your way through enterprise and an entrepreneurial spirit. It's quite another to come into immense wealth through no effort of your own. Are we seeing any links between the slowing of inventiveness and the slowing of applications for patents by Americans and this accumulated wealth?
We actually have numbers on that very point. 31% of billionaires inherited their money, which means 69% are self-made. So there is a perception that, a lot of these people just inherited their money. The Koch brothers actually are in that category. Their father established the business that created this great wealth. But, more than two-thirds of the billionaires actually started out in many cases with modest means, had some idea, and became very wealthy in the process.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have been talking about taxes. What's the best opinion of experts on this? What would be a fair wealth tax, and what could we do with all that money?
Well, right now, the tax is on income and not assets. Thomas Piketty, in his very prominent book, Capital, that came out 6 months ago, proposed a global wealth tax. Most people think that's not very practical, because if one country did that, then you have the flight of capital that takes place there. So it's been hard to really deal with that subject, because if you're only focusing on income during a time when there's great capital appreciation, you're going to end up in a situation where the rich are getting richer.
And we haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about billionaires in other countries. Do you see any patterns that are wildly different than what you've studied in the United States, Daryl?
Well, what I found when I looked internationally is this tie between wealth and politics is incredibly controversial in almost every country around the world. Everybody is kind of seeing the trends in this area and the growth of a great wealth and worrying about what it means for their individual society. So, at its most extreme form, you have the cases of China and Russia, where they're actively fighting the billionaires and keeping them out of the political process, putting them in jail if people start to field candidates, to other places, like I mentioned, Ukraine, where they're electing billionaires. So you really have this complete range of kind of open access to closed access to the political system on the part of various countries.
Linda in Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have a question of your guest. It's like, why, should I even bother to vote anymore when, some of these wealthy people have so much influence over the politicians? Then it's like, where does my vote even count in this process?
Well, Linda, you should vote, because your vote actually does matter. And we saw an example of this in 2012, when there were a handful of billionaires who spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to defeat President Obama, and they lost. So it is possible, if you have the right candidate and the right situation, to triumph over great wealth. I mean, money does not completely dictate outcomes, although it obviously has a great influence in the process. But what interested me is, the conservative billionaires who lost in 2012 are smart businessmen, and they went back and analyzed their failure in 2012. They fine-tuned their message in 2014. One of the lessons they drew is that they'd been too dry and analytical. They used too many statistics in 2012, kind of making the argument, big government is bad and long-term debt levels are way too high. So they refined their message. In 2014, they would put an ordinary couple around a kitchen table talking about the problems that Obamacare is creating for that particular family. So they tried to personalize the message. They tried to humanize the message. They were much more successful in 2014 than in 2012. Billionaires helped Republicans win back control of the Senate. So it's going to be interesting to see how all this plays out in 2016, because we've seen one election in which the big money lost, one election in which they won, and 2016 becomes the Trump card here.
They evidently did quite a good job recruiting minority candidates as well who won. The Republicans did, on the state level particularly.
Yeah, there have been interesting efforts to recruit minorities into the Republican Party to try and field female candidates. They tried to weed out the crazy individuals in the nominating process because, you know, part of the problem in 2012 was they had these individuals who were just making outlandish statements, and it created problems for the party as a whole. So the big money on the Republican side went into some of the GOP primaries and tried to find a mainstream candidate, you know, someone who is conservative but not crazy, in order to weed out these really crazy nominees who would say these inflammatory statements.
Thanks, Linda. Randy in Middleton, hi.
Hi. I felt compelled to call here because just yesterday I read Michael Lewis's review of your book in New Republic magazine, and which is also pretty, I hope you've, your guest has read it. It's also a pretty compelling essay on this.
And I have read it, and you know, it has generated like 15,000 shares on Facebook and Twitter, so it's really been a big help to the book.
Mm. Okay, great. And what I was interested in is what touched on the idea that you can get some actual peer pressure, some agreement among billionaires, sort of the way that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have been playing it already, to either make contributions or to agree that after you have your $500 million, maybe you should be a little more careful about accumulating so much wealth. Because I think, like with the incidents in Ferguson, we're starting to see that actually has consequences.
Mm. Absolutely. And the thing that will be interesting for me to watch is kind of how billionaires develop in the future. Like in the United States, we have almost 500 billionaires, and there are liberal billionaires, moderate, conservative, and libertarian billionaires. And on some issues, like, you know, increasing taxes on the wealthy, a lot of them are in agreement regardless of their ideological viewpoint. But on other issues, you know, you can have big fights among the billionaire class. And so what I'm going to watch for in 2016 is kind of how this plays out. I mean, what we've already seen is Hillary Clinton is starting to sign up billionaires for her campaign. So, for example, George Soros has signed up as co-chair of the Ready for Hillary PAC that's basically trying to get her to enter the race. There are other liberal billionaires who have signed on with her possible candidacy. So, you know, we may end up with a battle of liberal billionaires versus conservative billionaires in 2016.
Oh, thanks, Randy, very much for your interesting call. Joanne Minocqua, hi.
Hi. You mentioned about how many of the current billionaires have inherited their money, but you've also mentioned about the tech people who have become rich because of their knowledge and the businesses they've built up. Do we see any trend between the tech people and the people that inherit?
Well, certainly the tech billionaires have been very interesting because they got their money at a very early age. I mean, you have people in their 20s and 30s who basically are billionaires or maybe just a little bit below that. These people are going to have an enormous impact on society, economics, and politics just because they will have, you know, 40 years or more to basically spend their money and influence the process. So, you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook illustrates that type of thing. They are starting to edge into the political process. Zuckerberg, for example, formed an organization to try and push immigration reform. So he was not active in the same way that the Koch brothers have been on the conservative side. But there was an issue that he cared about, and it was important for his sector. So, you know, he put money into that. So I think the thing to watch is, you know, to what degree those young people who have a great wealth start to contest the political process, because in general, they tend to be more liberal than the conservative billionaires who've been very active to date.
Mm. Thank you very much. How many billionaires do you have as buddies, Daryl?
I have been fortunate in that I've had encounters with about 20 billionaires between my experience at Brown University and then being at Brookings. And so it's been interesting both to, you know, the ones who I know, you know, I like, I admire them in terms of their business success. But I argue in the book that even though we might admire individual billionaires, we still need to worry about the group as a whole, because the, you know, collectively these individuals control trillions of dollars, and some of them are now trying to convert their economic power into political power, and that's something that should worry everybody else.
Mm. Thank you. It's been a fascinating hour. Appreciate your time and for writing the book. Thanks, Daryl.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Daryl West, the book is Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. Daryl, Vice President of Governance Studies, Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution, taught at Brown for a number of years. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. And a reminder to be with us tomorrow, hour two of our show, the author of Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. Thank you for listening.